Ladies and gentlemen, sports fans alike, coming to you from the Rockford IceHawks studio here in Chicago, Illinois, this is Bill Swirsky's Sports Talk Chicago, one of the couple, two, three best podcasts around. This episode, we got the Blackhawks in a real fight to bring back the cup, the Bears re-signing a real solid guy, the Cubs, they got some neighborhood beef going on, and the White Sox seem to be falling apart at the seams. And the Bulls? They're trying to stop teams from taking one of their guys, as if. So grab yourself an ice cold one and a bowl of sausage. Sit down, park your keister, and listen to This is Bill Swirsky, Sports Talk Chicago.
I'm starting nine dickers.
All right. Sounds like we need to make a side bet.
Starts with a C, ends with an O, and in the middle is a cat.
I think his hair follicles pure malaria.
All right, gentlemen, the answer was the Bears.
Coach Ditka's hair could single-handedly cure our dependence on foreign oil.
Bears 31 to negative 7.
The Bears. He's a merciful Ditka.
The Bears.
A family show, my friend. No cursing.
Yeah, that kind of language, it belongs in the gutter, the speakeasy, and Coach Ditka's press conference. You know,
welcome to another episode of Bill Swirsky Sports Talk Chicago, coming to you from the Rockford IceHawks studio in Chicago, Illinois. First thing we're going to be talking about is my beloved Blackhawks. And in a few minutes, we're going to have Jason on to talk a little bit more about the Blackhawks and the hole that they've got themselves in. And we're recording this episode just before the Game 3, so might be a little bit delayed in getting the podcast up, but I can assure you we're recording this before Game 3. We've got some sound clips of Corey Crawford and Jonathan Toews talking about the horrific Game 2 loss. Let's take a listen.
It's going to be tough to win a hockey game when you give up how many goals in a short amount of time. Can't be giving up that. I don't know how many goals it was in the third. It definitely was a hockey game. That many goals in the third.
Well, they're going to be even better in their own building, so we got to expect that. We got to kind of reflect on what just happened and be ready to raise our own level of play. And, I think we're kind of ticked off that we might have let one slip away from us here in our own building, but can't dwell on it too much. We have to focus on what we can do better and, like I said, make sure we're ready.
Listen to those clips. It sounds to me a little bit like more dejection rather than fired up. And that scares me a little bit going into Game 3, is when, against the Wild, when Crawford talked about having a bad game, everything was very proactive. I have to play better. I'm going to put in a better performance. But here it sounds a little bit like he's just at a loss. And that's scary for me to hear, because that sounds like almost defeatist attitude going into Game 3. And going into Game 3... they're going to need to be at the best to be able to beat the Los Angeles Kings, who are on fire. And granted that they're not the best home team in the league, it's still they're playing at home, and that's always an advantage. Toews also sounds a little bit dejected. We want to see Toews come out and say, this is what we're going to do better. This is how we're going to come at this. And both players just sound like a little bit defeatist, and that's a little scary going into Game 3. So with that,
welcome to Bill Swirsky Sports Talk Chicago. Jason, you haven't been on in a few weeks. Are you excited to be back?
Yeah. What'd I miss?
I don't know. The Hawks did something or other and somebody else did something. I'm not sure.
How about that Wild, huh?
So this, what I was expecting to talk to you about after two games of the Western Conference Finals took a drastic turn going into the third period of Game 2.
I was
after, you know, 1 9/10 of the game, I was like, all right, we're going to be talking about we're two games up going into LA and we have the momentum. You know, can we sweep the series? And that in 22 minutes, that really took a turn for the worst. What were your thoughts on Game 2?
There were quite a few. The one obviously, like, having the time between game two and game three, like, you've got a lot more time to ponder on it. But I think the biggest thing that I've pulled from it is that at least it happened, like, at least they fell apart this early in the series, so they have plenty of time to hopefully bounce back. They also have a lot of time to sit on, like, because of the time between game two and game three, they've got a lot of time to sit on, you know, sit on their thoughts about what happened and, like, either build character from it or, you know, I should say build positive character from it and, like, learn from whatever mistakes they made or, you know, just pull their heads out of their keisters, or, you know, they could dwell on it and, you know, not so good things could happen from there.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the first period they played a really good game, and there was – I kept saying there was acts of nature that were preventing certain shots from going in.
Oh, yeah.
And I realistically thought that the Hawks could have been up like 5-0 after the first period. But I was content with, you know, 2-0, you know, going into what I thought was going to be going into the third period. And it just seemed like after that goal that went in for – I forgot who shot it in, the first goal for the Kings. But
I felt like – the trickle between the legs, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a rough one to see. But, I mean, those kind of goals will – I mean, and not only that, but on – that came, I mean, a little bit after that call, the goal was called back from the Hawks, which I actually didn't see that. I was listening to the radio at the time, or listening to the game at the time on the radio, but I, you know, those two calls back to back against you can easily be deflating. I didn't think it would be that deflating to the Hawks.
Going into, you know, the third, it was just like the wheels fell off of that, the train. It was like they almost – like they gave up. I hadn't seen them play like that in a long time because it was just like they weren't even there. And it was nice to see that Patrick Sharp is still playing for the Blackhawks because you know, I was a little shocked in that he hasn't done anything. And I thought
much maybe, in this series.
Well, not much in any of these series really. I figured maybe it was because of St. Louis's physical play – and then, you know, I just felt like I kept making excuses for why Sharp's not playing well. And it's just he's not playing well. There's no excuse to it.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of agree with you. But he definitely had that one game where he had the breakaway goal. I can't remember what game that was. But basically the defender's stick came up and got him in the face. And he, like, didn't phase him. He was going to draw the penalty instead. He just scored a sweet goal.
I mean, it was a little bit of a lucky goal. I mean, it just kind of trickled in. But I mean, when he had the other breakaway against Minnesota, that he could have just put that one home, and he couldn't beat the goalie one on one. It's just I don't know if there's like a nagging injury or what's going on with Sharpie, but it doesn't seem like anybody else is talking about it. You know, it just seems to be like whispers amongst fandom that. You know, what's going on with Sharpie, but none of the media outlets are talking about it.
Right. That could be very true. I remember last year, it wasn't until after they had won the cup that we heard about Hose's injury. So this could be another situation very much like that.
I mean, I hope it's not that. I hope it's just, you know, that he's in a slump, because if they're to get past LA, they're really going to need Sharp to play well in order to beat, you know, I'm guessing the Rangers.
Right. Oh, well, I don't know. They, what was it, a 3-2 win yesterday?
Yeah.
For Montreal?
Yeah, which is crazy is, you know, they lose both games in Montreal. They lose their goalie, but then they come into New York and win an overtime game. It's just
fingers a-blazing.
I don't know. I mean, it seems a little bit of an enigma, but – you know, I don't know, but I think that they're really going to need Sharp going forward, and hopefully this isn't an injury issue, that it's just a slump issue, because that he can come out of, you know, with one shot.
Right. I mean, you could easily point to Patrick Kane with that, like, the end of the season, even in the Olympics, he was kind of in a slump, and he got a goal and just built from it, and Now he's making some sweet backhanders over the corners or over the shoulders and popping corners like that. Goal on was that Ryan Miller that he scored that sweet goal on? No, that was against the Wild. The yeah, because you can read my mind. You know which one I'm thinking of.
Yeah, pretty much, it's what I do. I'm like a professional mind reader.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm thinking about the play where it looked like he may have intended to go for a drop pass, but he ended up maybe mishandling it and grabbed it, went around the circle and popped the corner with a backhand. And I'm pretty sure that was against the Wild in game four.
Game two of this Western Conference final. Once, I mean, throughout this playoffs, is Ben Smith has played really well and he's deserved to have a lot more goals go in, the shots go in on goal than half. Man. He's been playing so tough. So to be able to see him score was really cool and encouraging. And I thought that would be momentum for the Hawks, but it didn't turn out that way. Where do you see Ben Smith going forward with the playoffs here?
Oh, you know what? I mean, I don't, even though he's not getting goals, I think he's definitely contributing. He's winning 99.9% of the battles in the corners, coming out with the pucks and making the great passes. He's my favorite kind of player. He's a grinder. He works hard. I mean, that's probably because when I play, I don't score many goals, but I do. I try to win those battles as well. I guess I gravitate towards the similar style of play. I can't fault him for not scoring. Especially with the lines that he's been on, I should say the players that he's been put on lines with, his main objective is to get those pucks out of the corner and make those passes to the open guy in front, and that's what he's been doing. I can't knock him for his game. He's got top notch game.
Ben Smith seems to be playing the same type of game that Brandon Saad played last year for the Hawks, and that he's gotten away from a little bit. And so it's nice to see that with these young players, you know, sort of grinding and working hard to find their niche in the NHL, because there's going into the youth hockey and through the ranks of the minors, everybody's a scorer. I mean, even looking at if you read Bob Probert's book, going through the minors, he was a top scoring guy. But once you get into the NHL, it pretty much separates the men from the boys, and you have to find your own niche in order to sustain there. Because, you know, when you have a pool, everybody's a scorer coming into a league. They can't all be scorers when they're in the NHL, so they have to all find their niche.
Right, and I think what am I trying to say, or how should I say what I'm trying to say? Everybody can be a scorer. Everybody that's in the NHL is a phenomenal hockey player. They can easily be that scoring leader on the team, but everybody's delegated a role by the coach, and that's how your team's going to end up winning, is by you playing your role. And that is the role that Ben Smith plays, you know. And I wanted to bring up Saad like you did, or just to play on after you brought him up. I feel like he has not only lost a little bit of the gusto in the corner, I think he's lost a little bit of a step as well. When he first came on, I thought he was a great addition to pick up where Andrew Ladd left off. But I feel like this season, maybe it's kind of to the point that I was just saying, maybe he's been given a different role and just hasn't been asked to win those battles in the corners or beat the defenseman like he was before. I don't know why you wouldn't want him to, but maybe that's just maybe that's the reason for his speed decline that I myself have noticed.
I mean, it could also be a little bit of, I was listening to, I forget who it was, a television show about with commentators about hockey, and they were talking about how in the playoffs, coaches don't like to do line changes because everything's so tight that they don't like to do a lot of line switching because, you know, everything's so tight and the games are so highly contested and the series are so tight that you don't want to have a mistake and have that cost you a game, which is so important in the playoffs. But you look at a guy like Quenneville that You know, he wasn't even afraid. He wasn't even afraid to switch up defensive pairings in the middle of a game.
I mean, right, he juggles more than a clown.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Like, there was one game where, Seabrook and Duncan Keith are just like, that's the pairing, I forget who we mixed up with, but it was like Duncan Keith and maybe Sheldon Brookbank, and it was Jalmerson with Jalmerson was with maybe Roosevelt, but it was such an odd pairings, and he just did it in like a second period, and you were like, what is going on? And he's not even afraid to switch up defensive pairings, let alone line shifts. So
right.
He does a lot of tinkering, and sometimes a lot of times it turns out well, but sometimes it's just a little puzzling and doesn't work out well.
Right, and but at the same time, that's a good way to get your team comfortable with everybody. You know, if you can throw them on a line with anybody on the team, and another thing is that's a good way to protect your team from injuries. Like you can't keep you can't guarantee your teammates or your team won't get injured, but you can pretty much guarantee that if this person is out of the lineup, the other people that can step in and feel comfortable, and they'll have chemistry already with their line mates, their new line mates, I should say.
And speaking of injury, we've got Andrew Shaw potentially coming back for game three. I personally think that it's going to be a big boost for the Blackhawks because he's been so important for them last season and when he was playing healthy this season. And I think they've really missed just his scrapper mentality and willing to go in and be a body in front of the goalie or, get into scraps or whatever they need him to do. And I really think that they've been missing that.
Yeah, he's definitely a presence of energy on the ice. And the commentators during the games have talked about it numerous times that his presence in front of the net is missed, and they finally they'll point it out. And then of course, as it goes, the next couple of shifts, there will be somebody in front of the net, and they're like, yep, there you go. That's how he does it.
Yeah. But the one thing that I was thinking about, and it sort of came to light today, is once he does come back is who's going to be the healthy scratch. And it seems like Quenneville, the logical choice would probably be Bolig, but it seems that in this series, Quenneville really wants Bolig to be playing more. So
yeah,
it's
not like that guy.
And so I like Bolig, but he just doesn't seem like the guy you would want against. It seems to me he would want him more against a team like Minnesota or a team like St. Louis, and he really gave him healthy scratches a lot against Minnesota. But it's seeming like it's going to be Peter Regan that's going to be the healthy scratch, which is a little bit mind-boggling because I think he's played really well in these two and a half series so far.
Yeah, he's done pretty well. I definitely agree with you there. I don't know. I don't really like to anticipate what Quinville's going to do. I know I compared him to a clown for the juggling, but he is far from a clown, and the amazing things that he does, like when he does them sometimes, I'm just like, what is he doing? And then it works out. So I have to eat my words.
I mean, it is true. Like when they switched up the lines against Philadelphia in 2010, that really took a series that looked a little bit dismal and really turned it around and allowed the Hawks to overcome that really good defense and what Chris Pronger was doing. So, I do trust him a lot, but I do have questions sometimes when you see what he does. It's just a little bit questioning.
Yeah.
So I guess the last couple things that I wanted to bring up is there's reports about Eddie Olczyk possibly taking a job in the league office, replacing Brendan Shanahan as the discipline czar. What do you think about that?
I don't know. I've also heard that he's there's also some possibilities for him going to coaching as well. But I don't know. If he were to make that move to the to Shanahan land, then I mean, I think he'd do it. I should say, I think he'd do a great job. I'd hate to see him go. I'd hate to, the back and forth that him and Foley have is pretty entertaining. I know some people don't really enjoy it, the tree, turdy tree and a turds and whatnot, but, I don't know. I'm a child at heart. He makes me giggle.
Hey, all you young hockey players out there.
Yeah.
I would miss him in the booth, but I think it would be a good move for the NHL because I feel like he's a guy that's very well respected, and I think he's very thoughtful in what kind of discipline he would hand down and the reasonings why he was doing it. So I feel like players would know where the line was and what they couldn't do and if they did something, what kind of penalty they would expect from it, and it would be pretty fair. I feel like that's really important going forward in the NHL because with head injuries and things, there is changing of the mentality of the sport and what's considered kosher and not. And so I feel like the league really needs to have clear cut and defining lines, and they haven't had those. It's been a little bit of a moving target.
Yeah, it's definitely been a lot of case by case rulings, but I kind of like that because you definitely have some players that are repeat offenders, and you need to take into account so much of the details of the infraction, like leaving the feet, targeting the head, things of that nature.
Being Rafi Torres.
Last names, first names, yes.
Yeah, but that's sort of my point is that there's a lot of vagueness, and I mean I'm not sure if I ever sent it to you, but there was like a meme going around on the internet where it had like a flow chart of how to determine penalties in the NHL, and then it was like came down to was, well, is this repeat offender named Alexander Ovechkin? If so, no penalty or no fine or suspension. So it is a little bit of realism and humor mixed up is that, superstars get better treatment, which happens in every league, but I think some of that needs to stop at some point, because if you have a league that's really trying to end head injuries and have a safer product on the ice, you really need to be very clear of what's not okay and say, all right, well, a guy like Seabrook who plays very physical but isn't really known to be a dirty player, and he has what he did to David Backes, and do you look at that as the same as when David Backes, who's a clear-cut known headhunter, does it to somebody else, or a guy like Rafi Torres does it? Do you look at it differently as these are serial offenders? And I think you have to do that, and they need to be careful about overstepping a bounds for a guy doing it the first time and under penalizing somebody that's a repeat offender. I think that sends the wrong message to the league.
Well, yeah, I totally agree. The main objective for that position is to keep head injuries and just game, or I should say season ending injuries, to a minimum. And it's a hard line to walk, whether you go too hard or go soft, or I am pretty glad it's not my job.
And one last thing I wanted to talk to before I let you go is going into the two finals series, you hear a lot of national media talk about Quick is the best goalie left in the playoffs, and Henrik Lundqvist is probably the second best, like they're 1A, 1B. And that Carey Price is probably the third best, and Corey Crawford is the worst of the four goalies. But if you break it down statistically, Corey Crawford, going into game two of that series, had by far the best numbers of any of the four goalies going into the playoffs. Do you think that Corey Crawford is A, an elite goalie, and B, do you think he doesn't get the respect that he should for the play he's had? And the third thing is, why do you think he doesn't get that respect?
I will say he's definitely an elite goalie. The end of game two, everybody has good days, everybody has bad days. That was obviously not his finest moments, but I definitely think he's underrated, but I feel like he's got such a baby face. He doesn't have the face that like has the chiseled features of like a warrior in the net. You know what I mean?
Quick has a baby face too.
I guess you had a point there.
But Henrik Lundqvist looks like an old grizzled Wolverine.
Yeah, that's kind of what I had in my mind. You got that commercial of him battling a rhino of pucks, and he's just like, yeah, he looks like a Viking against pucks.
Yeah, I mean,
Crawford looks like a teddy bear.
I mean, I'm guessing some of it stems a little bit from after they won in 2010, that there was so much attention on Antti Niemi, and he got thrust into the spotlight. And people thought he was this, you know, very good high-end goalie. And when the Blackhawks let him go, Crawford was this also-ran. He was the one guy they had left, and that he got handed the, you know, keys to this throne, and, you know, be able to be a goalie for this really phenomenal team. And all he had to do was just not screw it up.
Stop a few pucks and everything would be fine. But yeah, I mean, the one thing that to counter your point is that, you know, that's they last year they won the cup, and most of the team has comments about how, I mean, Kane said it at the rally after they won the cup, that Crawford was slide on the MVP of the series. Like the team believes in him. Everybody else believes in him. That's why I think he's an elite goalie. I think there's the real reason that he's not known to the broad media outlets is that he's just, you know, he's still kind of a young goalie. How old's Lundqvist?
Well, I mean, Crawford's also ridiculously quiet. I mean, the guy could have run into a building and saved a 50 kids from a burning building, and they'd be like, "How do you feel?" He'd be like, "Good." Okay. he just is not an emotional guy. I think that's part of the problem. And I think also part of the problem is that he definitely had, you know, chinks in the armor in his goaltending skills, namely the glove side. Is he got beat high on the glove side pretty consistently, and I think that was something that all the teams in the league knew, and they all try to go top shelf glove side.
Right.
And I feel like this year he is such a superior goalie than he was last year.
Definitely, and on the glove side for sure.
Yeah.
He's, I mean, improved that game hard.
Stick side, he was always great. Yeah. I thought he was one of the better stick side goalies. And if he could just figure out that the glove arm isn't sewn to your side, that he would be a much better goalie. And I feel like he probably really worked on that in the off season, because he's been so much better this season, and the numbers show it, and the respect that he's being given just, you know, shows it. He had a bad game two. I mean, not even a bad game. He had, you know, a bad period in 2 minutes. And I look for him to bounce back. I think he's going to be the X factor in the rest of this series. I feel like Crawford is going to man up, and he's going to take it as a real challenge that he can't let more goals go in than Quick does.
Sort of just embellish your point a little bit, if you don't mind. I'm going to say, I think you mean Jonathan Quick.
Why do I keep calling him Mike Quick? What am I thinking? Oh, I'm thinking of the guy that used to play for the Eagles. Why do I keep...
what was I just going to say? Oh yeah. But, Quick had a game, last series where he just got blown out, and then he was just, I think he was lights out the rest of the series. So that's just kind of like the bounce back effect of goalies. That's one way it can go. I mean, it could go the other way too. I think after Niemi got blown out, in the first round, that first game, then he was pretty much just calling in sick, calling in fake injury, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, the Mike Quick thing is, I lived in Philadelphia. I don't know if the listeners know this. I lived in Philadelphia for about 9 years, which was really terrible. And, yeah. And Mike Quick.
You quit Chicago.
I quit Chicago. But Mike Quick played for the Philadelphia Eagles at wide receiver, and he was also one of their radio sports radio guys on their sports channel and was the commentator for the Eagles games. So I have it somehow just lodged in my head. But anyway, yeah, I think Crawford's going to be the X factor for the rest of the series. And he really – he – in against the Wild, when he had that bad game, he said, I had a bad game. Quenneville said he had a bad game. And the next game, he just basically stood on his head and stood tall when the Hawks were almost trying to give that game away, and Crawford single-handedly stopped these ridiculous shots that he had no business stopping.
Right. That game was a shutout after that one, right? Yeah, it was. I do recall.
I know you don't like predictions, but what do you expect to see in game three?
I expect overtime in game three. I'm hoping it's one overtime. Going to say, this is my prediction. It is going to go in overtime. The game is going to end at the 17-minute mark of the overtime period, and the Hawks will emerge victorious 3-2.
My prediction is everybody's going to have fun.
Fun to fun. Everybody wins.
That's my favorite score, fun to fun. I look for the Hawks to come out pretty aggressive to try to take the fans out of the L.A. I mean, I don't even know how many fans they have. It's L.A. and hockey. But I look for them to really try to take the sails out of the home ice advantage that the Kings have and be really aggressive in the beginning. And try to set the tempo, and then try to just put a lot of bodies in front of Quick and a lot of shots on goal rather than a lot of fancy passing. I think they're going to try to go aggressive, do shots, try to get bodies in front of the net. And I look for Crawford to really rebound and play well. So I think the Hawks take game three, but I don't think it goes overtime, but I think it's a really close game, and I'm looking for
– Yeah, I know.
A three-two victory.
All right, we agree on the score. I like it.
And it sounds like you're being beckoned to come into your game. So, I guess we'll let you go. And thanks for coming on the show. And hopefully, we can have you on next time when the Hawks win the series 4-1, and go on to play whoever in the Stanley Cup Finals.
Sounds good. Hey, if I may bait you a little bit, can you ask me about my prediction for my game that I'm about to play now?
How many goals are you going to score?
No. Just ask me what my prediction is.
What's your prediction?
My prediction? Pain!
Thanks, Clubber Lang. All right, Jason. Thanks a lot.
All right, man. See you later.
Well, thanks, Jason, for coming on the show. Always great to talk to you. I promised you we were going to have a lot of talk about the Cubs and the business model and the renovations and all that good stuff. But first, let's go move to the Chicago Bears. I think let's get these things out of the way and discuss them. And then later on in the show, go on to the Cubs and the big talk I had for you. And the first WTF moment of this past week is Brandon Marshall going on The View and signing a new contract with the Bears. All of this coming out of left field. I mean, there was no rumors about him potentially having a contract signed. I mean, I think we all knew that the Bears management would love to re-sign Brandon Marshall. He's a guy that's in his prime currently, and he's been a huge part of the Bears' resurgence on offense, and he's helped make Alshon Jeffrey better. We're hoping and counting on him helping make Marquise Wilson better, making Brandon Marshall better, making everybody on the team better with his leadership in his play.
You have Alshon Jeffrey emerge as one of the best receivers in the NFL. You know, I have Martellus Bennett, which I think is the best tight end in the business. You know, and you have our offensive line, and we go from, you know, being in the bottom, way bottom, to top. I think we were third and giving up sacks last year. So it makes everybody's job easier.
And it's funny to hear us talk about this because when he was brought over by the Bears from Miami Dolphins, the Dolphins fans were like, we got 2 third-round picks for this loser. But when we got him, fans on our team were all over the map because are we getting the Brandon Marshall who played in Denver and played really well with Jay Cutler? Or are we getting the guy who punches women and loses his mind and has this severe mental disorder and played terribly in Miami? Which guy were we getting? And I think it's pretty evident that not only has it been more than the Denver Broncos, Brandon Marshall, it's been beyond that. He's been phenomenal. He's been a great teammate. He's taken people under his wing. He's been a vocal leader, spiritual leader. He's been a really good guy to have on this team, not only in this team, in this city. So being able to extend him for 3 more years, so having him for a total of at least four years in the Chicago Bears uniform, potentially the last 4 years of his career, that's a really great move on the Bears' part, and I think that's going to project well on him and his preparation for the season going forward and beyond.
We're getting older, and we understand that it's time to get it done now.
Now, going on The View to be able to sign this contract, that's weird. And from what I'm gathering is he had already planned a visit to The View, probably talking about mental health awareness. I didn't. I'll have you know, don't watch The View, one, because I don't, and two, because I actually have a job during the day. But it was a good opportunity for him to sign the new contract. So to each his own. I just wonder is the next player that signed going to go on Wendy Williams? If they don't sign, are they going to go on Maury with the lie detector test? Who knows? So, but we got Brandon Marshall 4 more years, and I think that's a really positive move, especially the contract that he has. He's making a lot of money, but he's not getting some kind of crazy money where he's really going to tie up the team financially. Look at Larry Fitzgerald. Even though he keeps deferring money, he's making so much money that it's a hindrance to the team, and they can't really do anything. So Brandon Marshall's contract, he's going to be making $10 million a year for the next 4 years. And I think that's a good enough money where he's going to be very happy, very comfortable, but it allows the Bears a lot of freedom to be able to move on and make other signings, which I still think they're going to do this offseason. Then we have some things coming out of rookie minicamp. Everybody is there and looks okay. Christian Jones is looking like he's going to be a player. And like as I told you when we did our talks about the different positions, that he was a guy that I really liked, even though a lot of scouts didn't like him. Bears got him as an undrafted rookie. He's looking like he's probably going to make the squad based on what things are coming out about him and how he's looked in rookie minicamp and how he's preparing going into the season. And that's huge. Because I think the Bears were in an awkward situation with linebackers because they could have a very good situation, or at least more than serviceable, but they could also have something bottom out very quickly because you're depending on unknowns and older players. So does Lance Briggs hold up? Does DJ Williams hold up? Does Shea McClellan step in and play a linebacker spot well? Does John Bostic take a step forward? Kasim Green, does he take a step forward? Christian Jones, does he take, make a big step and project well in the NFL? So if you have the two veterans hold up, Lance Briggs and DJ Williams, if they hold up physically and play to the capability that they have, Lance Briggs at the Pro Bowl level, even if he takes one step back or half step back, DJ Williams plays like he did when he was healthy last year, and you have one of Shea McClellan, John Bostic, Kasim Green, Christian Jones step forward, you suddenly have a very solid linebacking core. But if Briggs gets hurt, if DJ Williams gets hurt, which I think most of us suspect because he hasn't played healthy for a whole year ever, I don't think, and Shea McClellan doesn't pan out as they are hoping at a linebacker spot, and even though he's prepared hard and done the things he needs to do, and I thought he was a linebacker coming out of college. Or if Bostic doesn't take the step up, or Christian Jones shows that he really is an undrafted rookie and he's going to play like that, things could be really disastrous for the Bears, because even though they've improved on the back end and the front end, the linebacker spot, if a couple of bad breaks and suddenly they're right back where they were last year. So the final bit of Bears news in this slow offseason period I want to talk about is the upcoming or the pending class action lawsuit being filed against the NFL, featuring three of the prominent Chicago Bears from the 85 Super Bowl team. You have Keith Van Horn, Richard Dent, and Jim McMahon. So basically what they're saying in this lawsuit is that teams and doctors and the NFL itself were covering up not only how serious players' injuries were, and forcing them to, or encouraging them to play through these injuries by not telling them how bad they were. Also, they were saying, well, you gave us these painkillers. You didn't tell us what the side effects were. We got addicted. We got all these side effects. We have permanent injuries by playing through the pain because you put us on these painkillers and didn't tell us how bad these injuries were. So they're trying to make it into a class action lawsuit. I believe right now it's 8 players involved in the lawsuit. So McMahon is saying that he had an addiction to the pain medicine and he was taking 100 Percocets a month. And as a pharmacist, I can tell you it's a lot of Percocet. It's nowhere near what I see people on, but nobody should be on, unless you have cancer or sickle cell anemia or something, probably shouldn't be taking 100 Percocets a month. It's a lot. And he was taking that during the off season when his body should have been healing rather than still in these pain mode. So leads to believe that there was a lot of addiction going on based on not knowing what they were taking and the potential risks of the medication. Richard Dent is saying that he hurt his leg during a game against the Seahawks, and now he has permanent nerve injury because he played through it instead of having the surgery, and because he was basing his decision on information that he got from the team doctors. So he's part of this lawsuit, and probably the one that, I mean, I could see a little both sides is, did they understand what they were being told? Did they get both sides and they wanted to play, but now that they're hurt, that they're filing a lawsuit? The one that really boggles my mind, I can't even see both sides, I can only see the player side of it, is Keith Van Horn said that one season he played with a broken leg the whole season. He played on a broken leg. I've never broken a bone, but I see people with broken bones and they don't look like they're doing so well, let alone be able to play at an NFL level. But they just hopped him up on drugs and put him out on the field. Played the whole season with a broken leg. That reminds me a little bit of, have you guys ever seen one of those strongman competitions that they used to have on ESPN? And maybe they still have them. World's Strongest Man. There was a guy, didn't speak English, but he was doing the torpedo carry, where they're carrying like 700 pounds of metal with handles. And the whole time he's walking and he's hobbling. He didn't speak English, so the announcer asked his manager, they said, there seemed to be something wrong with your man's ankle. The guy in the thick Eastern European accent goes, that is because it is broken. This guy was walking around on a racing carrying 700 pounds with a broken ankle. These guys are nuts. Guess the testosterone flowing through you. But going back to Keith Van Horn, that's still incredible to think that he played the whole season with a broken leg and the doctors didn't tell him. They just put this compression on him to keep the swelling down and pumped him full of pain reliever. So that's something to really keep an eye out. The NFL, it's funny, this league is just growing and growing and growing, and it seems like there's no stop. And I think what's going to eventually stop their growth is the things that they've done in the past catching up with them. The concussions, the injury, and things that happened with the previous players that have all since retired and what they went through. And I think that's really going to catch up to the NFL, whether it be money or bad publicity or whatnot. It's really going to catch up. And I think Roger Goodell really needs to be proactive and really come out and say, here's things in the past that happened. Here's what we're doing to make them right. And actually acknowledge that they did wrong, because I think that will go a lot more way, a lot further, and be proactive, because if he's reactive, it's going to cost them more money. It's going to cost them bad publicity. So those are the things that I think Roger Goodell really needs to step up and do going forward. And I guess one last quick bit is looking at the roster and who's actually on the Bears currently, which is going to be a lot higher than the active roster come game one. But they're allowed to carry a lot more players going into the mini camps. But looking at the roster and who they have, who I think is going to be weeded out, you know, just on the first thoughts and news bits coming out after rookie minicamp and whatnot, I really don't see the Bears roster staying the same as it is right now. I really see, you know, some surprise veterans or some, you know, players being cut that the Bears will pick up to bring in to be, I guess, more reserves or insurance policies for some positions, maybe safety, maybe corner, maybe linebacker, maybe running back. We'll see how this pans out, but I'm thinking that this roster is really not going to be done yet, and Phil Emery is still scouring the wires to see who's been available, who's cut, who's released, whatnot, because I don't think this roster is done.
The Bears are what we thought they were. The Bears are who we thought they were. If you want to crown them, then crown them. But they are who we thought they were.
I guess that's going to wrap up Bears talk. Not much going on. Off-season, rookie minicamps kind of closed to the public. There's really nothing there everywhere, anywhere. They're in shorts and no live action. I was hoping to have Gary on the show because I really wanted to talk more about these more Tom Thibodeau rumors that have been coming about, but he was unavailable. Maybe next week we'll have him. It's Memorial Day weekend and he's got a family, so they've got to take precedence.
Everyone has to do their job.
It seems that Tom Thibodeau, anytime there's a coaching vacancy, is just being, they're saying, hey, look, Tom Thibodeau, let's put him in this coaching role and that coaching role. And at some point, these rumors have to be coming from somewhere. They can't just be, you know, nonsense rumors. Where does this all come from? I mean, is he really unhappy? Are some of these reports of his feuds with Pax and Gar, they true? To what degree? Is he still that mad about Luol Deng being traded? I mean, I know he loved the guy, but just for the money he was making, it just didn't make any sense. And then, well, you know, we talked a little bit about that last week. Nothing really new to report, but it just seems that his name keeps popping up nonstop, nonstop, nonstop. So I'm kind of interested to see where this goes. Are they really going to trade him? I mean, if somebody offers them a lottery pick, do you take the lottery pick and go for a new coach? It's something to really keep an eye on. The other thing going forward is one of the players that people kept associating with the Chicago Bulls and being able to pull forward and bring this player to the team is Kevin Love. For years, people have been saying, what about Kevin Love? What about bringing Kevin Love to the Bulls? Kevin Love, the Chicago Bull. Kevin Love with Derrick Rose. Are they friends? How will they work together? Well, finally, we have some real news to talk about. Is Kevin Love said, I'm going to opt out of my contract as soon as it's available. I'm legally allowed to. He, through his agent, told the team, do what you need to do accordingly. I'm not going to re-sign with the Minnesota Timberwolves. I'm going to opt out. So basically he's saying, get what you can for me, trade me away. And I think that's, on one hand, it's a little frustrating that teams or players are dictating to teams what, you know, the contract is going to be, how things are going to be. And I know in free agency that, you know, the players are, they're not slaves, they are, they're human beings that are allowed to work where they want. But when they sign a contract, I think that they have to somewhat abide by that contract and saying, well, I'm opting out, but abide by your contract a little bit. But I also see his point is I don't want to stay in Minnesota. I want to actually go somewhere where I have a chance to play in a big market for a chance to win a championship. So trade me away because I'm not going, and I don't want you to get nothing for me. If I just go in free agency, you're not going to get anything. at least get something for me, whatever that may be, so you can build your team going forward. And that little bit, that's admirable. So it's, I see both sides of the coin there. So then that starts begging the question, is the Bulls have probably enough money to get, you know, maybe with some roster moves, but enough money to get one big time player. And do you go with a guy like Kevin Love, or do you go like with a guy like Carmelo? So then that poses, you know, a hypothetical question is, if you're able to get either player, do you go Kevin Love or do you go Carmelo Anthony? And that sort of has a question that you look stylistically of who's going to be the guy that's going to work with Derrick Rose and Joakim Noah and Tom Thibodeau towards actually bringing you a championship. Who's going to be the one that helps you compete and go past the Miami Heat and LeBron James? Is which guy is going to do that better? I like Kevin Love better, but I don't know if he's going to be the guy that can carry you, because he's never had a playoff win. I don't even know if he's ever been to the playoffs. Carmelo Anthony's a guy who he can take over a game and score. And that's really what the Bulls need, is that they're a phenomenal defensive team, but they're atrocious on offense. And you need a guy that's going to be able to take the ball in any situation, whether it's double team and or even if they're trying and they have a game plan to stop Carmelo Anthony, they need a guy like Carmelo Anthony who can say, I don't care if you try to stop me. I can still be Carmelo Anthony and put the ball in the hoop. Or if you create a double team and really step up to try to stop him, hopefully he can make plays and allow other guys to score. And if you have Derrick Rose coming back, hopefully 100%, but probably not. But you have a guy who's a former MVP, pairing with Carmelo Anthony, suddenly you have two options on offense. And if you have a situation like you did this year where you run your offense through Joakim Noah, and then you have two guys who can actually score on offense, is suddenly you might have a semblance of an offense. You couple that with the defense of Tom Thibodeau and the Bulls play, you actually have a legitimate shot to unthrone the Miami Heat. So even though I like Kevin Love as a player better and I like his style better, I personally think that Carmelo Anthony is the way to go. If you guys disagree, let me know. Just write in, call in, whatever you want to do is let me know. And even if you think there's a third option out there that could be the answer for the Bulls, let me know. I'd like to hear from you. The final thing I want to talk about with the Chicago Bulls is that the draft is coming up. We know that they did the lottery picks, and Cleveland got the number one pick, surprisingly, again. So seems like it's becoming a thing that the Cleveland Cavaliers get the number one pick every year. But the Bulls didn't have a lottery pick, but they do have two mid-first rounders, I believe it's 16 and 19. Discussed it with Gary and kind of looked at it. I'm more of an NFL guy, so I understand how NFL draft and trades work, but doesn't seem like they can move anywhere by trading those picks for something else. So I've been kind of looking at the mock drafts and some of the players that the experts feel will be available in there. One guy that's really intriguing to me is Adrian Payne from Michigan State. He's a guy, he's a power forward. He's all just shy of 7 foot. He reminds me a lot of Taj Gibson. So the reason he's intriguing is that some of the scenarios where the Bulls are able to sign a big-time guy to a big-time contract involve trading Taj Gibson either for a sign-and-trade or to make room to be able to sign the guy. So if you get rid of Taj while his iron is hot, while he's at his highest value in trade, and you have the capability to draft a guy who plays a lot like Taj but is younger and cheaper, that seems like a really smart way to go. And as I was discussing with Gary last week, is the problem with Chicago sports fans and Chicago sports ownership is that it is nice that they value their own so much, but it comes to a point where the whole purpose of this business is to win championships. And it doesn't matter if you value your guy and you like your guy. You can like your guy all you want, but if he's not going to bring you a championship, what you need to do is move on. And I think that's the case of Taj Gibson, is He's a guy who we all love. He works hard. He's a really blue-collar type, pull-yourself-up-by-your-bootstraps guy that's making it in the NBA. But he's not going to help us win the title. So it's time to part ways with him while his trade value is high, especially if we can get a guy who plays very similarly that's younger and cheaper. And you wish him well wherever he goes, and you don't wish him ill will or anything, and you keep the lines open and understand that it's a business. But you say goodbye to Taj Gibson. Bring in another guy. So coming in the next weeks, we'll look more at the players that are potentially going to be there for the Chicago Bulls and what they could do with those picks to hopefully make the team better. If there's scoring options, if there's guys to bolster the defense, we're looking at bench mob guys, what we have. I'm not the biggest basketball guy. I do watch, but I'm more of a baseball, hockey, football guy. So we'll have Gary and some other guests come on and just discuss the potential guys that are coming out of the draft into the NBA, who's available for the Bulls, and what they're going to look like. And then the last thing we'll touch on before we head to our big Cubs talk is the White Sox. And I'm just going to take a quick break here to say that we are recording from the Rockford IceHog Studio, icehogs.com. Check them out. Start purchasing your season tickets now. So the White Sox have been playing really well, hovering around 500, staying in the thick of the things for the wild card race. Detroit's kind of running away with that division, which most people expected. But they've been hanging around 500. They really do have a legitimate chance at the wild card. But they just have this rash of injuries. It's really frustrating, and it just seems like they have this dark cloud hanging over them. Chris Sale was on the DL for about a month, and as soon as he comes back, you have Lidstrom going on the DL. And Chris Sale comes back, and he's been pitching well, but do they have him on a short leash? Because he's a guy that looks like he could potentially have some elbow Tommy John type injuries in his future. So you really sort of, the modern baseball way of thinking is you want to watch his pitch count, you want to watch how he throws, and you need to keep an eye on that. So he comes out and he has a really good game against the Yankees. You watch him and you really want to see what's he got going forward. And he's an amazing pitcher, but he's a guy that you watch him pitch and you suspect that he's got injuries in his future. What's kind of ironic about it is the other day I was listening to Leo Mazzoni, who was the pitching coach for the Atlanta Braves when they had Glavine and Smoltz and Maddox, and they were just a phenomenal team with an amazing pitching staff. He was their pitching coach, and he was talking, now that I believe he's retired, they were talking about all of this rash of Tommy John injuries and other injuries. And we think we've had like almost 30 Tommy John surgeries already this season so far. And what he had to say was really had me thinking. He said that the thinking now is you limit the guy's pitch counts, you don't let him pitch too often, and you really baby these young pitchers. But he said that to him just seems so stupid, because he thinks that the way you have injuries is that you do these things, you limit the pitch count, but you let the guys pitch as hard as they want and throw as hard as they can every time, but you limit the number of times they pitch, and then you limit how often they can pitch. So then you got a guy that gets a stiff arm, but then, you know, when he's not pitching, he's not keeping it worked like he would, and then he comes in and just starts firing as hard as he can. And he thought the best way to keep guys injury free and playing well is that you pitch them more, or you keep them working more often. Throw on their off days. Let them do things to keep their arm in shape. It's kind of, I liken it to a runner. He's not going to, if he has a big race, he doesn't run only when the races are. He's going to run all the time because he needs to keep his body used to running, so he doesn't have injuries and things when he does his race. This is the same thing. His pitchers should pitch in their off games, because you want them to come in and have a warmed up arm and have it being loose and conditioned. And when you're in the game, don't throw every pitch like you're trying to throw it through the back wall. is be controlled in how you pitch it. You don't have to pitch ridiculously hard every single time. Be controlled. And that's how he had his Braves pitchers, and they were able to stay so healthy and so productive for so long. And he doesn't understand why that today's pitchers are being treated this way, because the injuries are mounting more and more. And he also said that he thought that the players are lifting too much, because that's a contributor. And he's not the only one that said that. Is Peter Gammons and a lot of the older guys that really think that players are lifting too much. So how does this relate to the White Sox? Is they're treating Chris Sale not to the degree that Washington has treated Steven Strasburg. Chris Sale, they have had him on a little bit of a short leash, and they are trying to keep him fresh and limit his pitch counts a little bit. Not to the degree some other teams are, but they are doing it. So you really worry that, is this something that's going to lead to something more serious down the road? Because the White Sox, if they have any chance to win, really sits on the back of two guys, Chris Sale and Jose Abreu. Those, regardless of how good the team is around them, good or bad, is those are the two guys that are going to need to carry the load in order to take them in the future. So now we move on to what I've been teasing at for a long time, is the Chicago Cubs. And this team is really hard to figure out. They're playing atrociously. They have the second worst record in baseball, only behind the Houston Astros. But their pitching, the front end pitching, has been pretty good. Samardzija, Hamill, like all these guys have been Wood. Everybody's been, except for Edwin Jackson, have been pitching really well. Their starters have been pitching really well. But their offense has been, it's been such a roller coaster. Is one game they're putting up 17, one game nothing, one game a bunch of strikeouts, one game they're hitting well. And I guess that goes to the fact that you have a team with a bunch of young players who are just really inconsistent, and they're riding this roller coaster together rather than what you need to win a string of games is have at least a couple people stepping up every game, because baseball is all ebb and flow. Even the best players, they go through cold and hot streaks. It's just a fact of baseball. But when everybody goes on the cold streak together and everyone goes on the hot streak together, that really doesn't help you put together a string of wins, is what you need to do to be competitive in baseball. Even the teams that are some of the greatest teams of all time, they lose like 60 games plus every year. That's a lot of games to lose. So there's always room to lose. When you're really good, is what you do is you win several in a row, you lose a game. Win several in a row, you lose a game. You don't do these losing streaks, which is what the Cubs have been doing. So what they need is these young offensive players, position players, to start playing more consistently and be able to start hitting timely and being able to, you know, find their own flow rather than going with the flow of the team. And one of the weird statistics that kind of looking at is run differential. So that's you take the number of runs you've scored and then subtract off the number of runs that you've allowed. And it's not a statistic that per se means anything or is going to predict what you're going to do. But on average, kind of what you look at when you see it is the team. Clearly, is the teams that are doing really well have a plus high number, and the teams that are doing really bad, they have a minus high number. And that really falls true most of the time. So kind of taking a look here, Toronto is first place in the American League East, which is traditionally one of the toughest divisions to win. They're in first place by a couple of games. Their run differential is a plus 23. That's pretty good. Then you look at Detroit, who's in first place in the AL Central. They're a plus 29. You look at Oakland, who's pulling away or trying to pull away in the AL West. They're a plus 90. They're a team that is just scoring a ton of runs and not giving up very many runs. Atlanta and Miami are fighting for that spot, the number one spot in the AL or NL East. They're a plus 14 and a plus 20. And then you have San Francisco, who's starting to run away with the NL West, and they're a plus 42. So all the teams that are in first place are starting to increase this, you know, this run differential number. They're scoring more runs, giving up less runs. Makes sense. You're winning games by scoring more runs. And then you look at the teams that are terrible. Arizona, not very good. They're minus 68. So they've on the season have given up 68 more runs than they've scored. You look at Philadelphia, who is not doing terribly, but they're not doing well. They're a minus 36. Houston, worst record in baseball, minus 56. Boston, who's in last place in the AL East, they're a minus 27. You think to yourself, well, the Chicago Cubs are the second worst record in baseball. They've got to be somewhere over there. The minus 30s, minus 40s, minus 20, late 20s, 20, so somewhere between like 27 and 50 or so minus. But you look at them, they're minus 6. Minus 6. You look at that number, that type of number is a team that is hovering just below 500. The White Sox are a minus 16, and they're right around, they're two games under 500. Teams that are a minus 6 is the Yankees are a minus 6, and they're in second place, only two games out of first. Baltimore is a minus 6. They're 2.5 games out of first. It's really mind-numbing is that you could say, well, they've had games where they scored 17 runs. But then you look at the other side of it, and they've had games where they gave up 11, 12. So these things even out. So the thing is that what this sort of tells me is that the Cubs are in a lot of their games, even the ones that they're losing, that they're not most of the time they're right there and within a chance to win. So it's really frustrating that this is a team that very easily could be hovering around 500 rather than that sitting at the bottom of baseball standings. That's a good sign. I mean, it's not a good sign to have a terrible record, but it's a good sign to see that they're that close to being a team that's really improved, because a 500 record would be like, with what we've been getting, it's almost like a World Series victory. Having a team that could flirt with 500 is phenomenal, and that's the way that the style that they're playing. If they can just do a couple of things, like have some players be a little more consistent and have players spread out when they're on fire on at-bats. So Rizzo, Castro, aren't all hitting on the same game, is that they're hitting on games when it's close and they need them to hit. And they spread that out, and everybody's going on their roller coaster up and down, not within, you know, the same pattern where they're overlapping a little bit and spreading each other out. So Olt and Rizzo are hitting well in one game, and Lake and Castro are hitting well in another game, and you know, Sherholtz is hitting in one game, and Wellington Castillo is hitting in one game. And that's where you have a guy, Bonifacio, is hitting in the game. You have a team that somebody is always stepping up every game to give you the offense that you need. And you want to limit the slumps that everybody's in. So that's encouraging going into the later half of the first half of the season, that you have a team that is actually holding their own as far as pitching well and being able to stay in games. You hope that having these guys get a little more conditioned during the season, maybe towards the end of the season, bring up some reinforcements from the young kids, is that you start putting a presentable team on the field. You start putting a presentable team on the field, and hitting begets hitting. Everyone, hitting's contagious. You start putting some wins together, winning's contagious. String a couple wins together, guys get excited, they like winning, so they start playing better, they start winning some more. You get guys that are hitting, other guys, hitting's contagious, so that you start hitting better. And you string a couple of these things together, and you have a team that's been competitive all season, even though they're losing, start putting together a few wins, and you have a whole new ball game. And it's not going to be anything for this season. I mean, we're too far out of the standings, but this looks good going forward for next season and the season after, when you see the team start to hopefully have more money to be able to spend on free agents, have some of these guys stepping up into the majors from the minors, and you have everybody gaining a little more experience, and suddenly you start to become a threat sooner rather than later. Which leads us directly into what I was been teasing about, is the Cubs' finances. So The Chicago Cubs, as we all know, have new ownership as of a couple years ago. And fans see them not spending money and losing a lot. And all of the talk is about these kids that are coming up and them being the future. But what does that mean for us now? Are they going to give us a baseball prospectus issue every time we go to the games? So it's really a complicated thing that isn't just, well, why aren't they spending money? Why aren't they doing this? And I wanted to really look into what it was that was making this team tick and how it was working and how the finances were affecting baseball operations and how baseball operations were affecting finances and how a family that owns a team that they have a ton of money, how is it that they can't spend any money? And their payroll has plummeted to the point where the Major League Baseball Players Association is asking questions. They went from $140-some million payroll down to $144 million payroll down to, I think it's $93 million right now. And once they trade Samardzija and some of these other guys at the trade deadline, it's going to go down even more. So where's this money going? And then we also have, in this past week, the announcement that Tom Ricketts is going to move ahead with the original baseball development plan for the stadium and saying, basically, screw the rooftop owners, sue us. And so let's hear Tom Ricketts in his infamous video talk a little bit about what they're doing and what they need to do going forward. So take a listen. This is Tom Ricketts, owner of the Chicago Cubs. So let's start with the rooftop owners and what they have as a contract with the Chicago Cubs. We all hear the rooftop owners and the Cubs can't block their sight lines and it's a business that they have a contract with and everyone throws these terms out. But let's really look at what the contract is in itself. I went through and I dug up and found what the wording in the contract is. The contract with the Chicago Cubs and the rooftop owners was signed when the team ownership was still with the Chicago Tribune Company. So this is something that the Ricketts family inherited when they bought the team. The agreement is dated January 27th, 2004, and it runs until December 31st of 2023. And it says a number of interesting things above and beyond giving the rooftops the right to run their business. Among them, some of the provisions include the following. Provision 6.6. The Cubs shall not erect windscreens or other barriers to obstruct the views of the rooftops, provided, however, that temporary items such as banners, flags, and decorations for special occasions shall not be considered as having been erected to construct views of the rooftops. Any expansion of Wrigley Field approved by governmental authorities shall not be in violation of this agreement, including this section. Section 7.3. From time to time during each season, the Cubs shall authorize WGN-TV or other Cubs broadcasting partners to identify a phone number where fans can call to reserve rooftop seating. 7.4. The rooftop shall have the right to inform the public that they are endorsed by the Cubs. 7.5. The Cubs director of marketing shall meet with the rooftops before the start of each Major League Baseball season to discuss opportunities for joint marketing. 7.6. The Cubs shall include a discussion about the rooftops on their tour of Wrigley Field and shall include stories positive about the rooftops in the Vine Line, which is Chicago Cubs magazine. 7.7. Each of the rooftops may display broadcasts of Chicago games to patrons at its facility, including displaying such broadcasts on multiple television sets without any infringement of any copyright owned by the Chicago Cubs or its assignees. The fact that those rooftops were showing the game broadcast on multiple television became an issue and one of the things that spurred both sides to agree on this deal back in 2004. Now, looking at some of the above clauses in the contract, we find some very interesting things. Section 6.6, the main point of contention between the sides can be interpreted in different ways. I read what an attorney who's versed in the law, obviously, when he reviewed the contract, what he had to say about this section. The last line, what he said was, the last line of 6.6 is the one that an arbitrator might have to decide. And let's be clear that unless both sides agree, the contract does not provide an avenue for a lawsuit in the typical sense of the word. Instead, it sends both parties before an arbitration panel. The arbitration process will keep everything in the litigation confidential as opposed to a federal lawsuit, which becomes part of the public record. Now, in looking at 6.6, the question that will have to be decided is whether or not the word expansion will apply to a sign or a jumbotron. Looking at the wording in the contract, any expansion of Wrigley Field approved by governmental authority shall not be in violation of this agreement, including this section. Is a sign in right field or a jumbotron in left field an expansion of Wrigley Field? Or is an expansion of Wrigley Field something that would have to include seating or making the ballpark bigger? This is no slam dunk win for the Cubs, although I think that they would ultimately prevail, but I would say the same about the rooftops. Another important part of the contract in the section 6.2 is if the Cubs expand Wrigley Field bleacher seating and such expansion so impairs the view of from the rooftops into Wrigley Field, such the rooftop business is no longer viable, even if they were to increase its available seating to the maximum height permitted by law, and if such bleacher expansion is completed within 8 years of the effective date, then if such rooftop elects to cease operation before the beginning of the next baseball season following completion of such expansion, the Cubs shall reimburse the rooftop 50% of the royalties paid by the rooftop to the Chicago Cubs during the time between the effective date and the date of expansion of the Wrigley Field bleachers. The Cubs shall pay such reimbursement to the rooftop within 30 days of receiving notice from the rooftop it is no longer viable and has ceased operation. Any rooftop receiving payment from the Cubs pursuant to this provision shall cease operation for the remainder of the term and shall not seek or accept any compensation or benefit related to activity on a rooftop on a day of any game. Looking at this clause, I'm going to pause for a second and say that a lot of the issues here are the language written in this contract particularly is so vague in some things that it's surprising that a trained and licensed lawyer wrote this. It seems that even though it gives the rooftops a lot of leverage, it also comes to the point that it has a lot of loopholes for the Cubs to get out of. And this is one such case. So the legal opinion on this clause look at an 8-year period that the Cubs are liable for potentially having to refund royalties and believe the Cubs could possibly win in an arbitrator's opinion of this section of the contract. Are the Cubs only liable for damages during this 8-year period that the agreement goes? Or are they liable for the entire 20 years of the contract? It seems that the Cubs have a solid chance to have an arbitration panel agree with them that the 8-year period, which has already expired, it expired on January 27th of 2012, was the only time in the contract that the Chicago Cubs were on the hook for a financial penalty or returning of royalties. From the Cubs' perspective, they believe that they have lived up to the contract and have the written agreement that says that with a governmental approval, any expansion of Wrigley Field shall not be in violation of this agreement. The Cubs also believe that the 8-year period for returning royalties has expired, which means that there is no avenue for damages. The rooftops would proceed at their own risk, so to speak. The Cubs have also been careful to phrase everything that they have done to the park over the past several years as an expansion rather than a renovation or remodeling of the park and the surrounding area. The Cubs keep calling everything an expansion. They put up a net, an expansion. They do this, it's an expansion, because they want to do so to establish, if they were to go to arbitration, that they are calling everything and being very consistent at calling everything expansion, because if they call it a renovation, they are changing the way that, in good faith of the contract, how things are looked to an arbitrator. Finally, is if you look at city records, which are public record, on July 24th, 2013, the Chicago City Council passed by a vote of 49-0 the following. Specifically, but without limitation, applicant shall have the right to expand the Wrigley Field bleachers to install, one, a new video board in left field, which may include an LED sign, a neon illuminated sign above it, and two light towers to assist in outfield lighting, and two, a neon sign in right field, which signage has been approved by the Commission on Chicago Landmarks, and in addition to being part of the bleacher expansion, and along with the other signage contemplated by this planned development, is integral to the expansion and renovation of Wrigley Field, and the development and redevelopment of the property is contemplated herein. They have the approval of the city of Chicago, and they believe that what they're doing is an expansion and is beyond this 8-year window of the rooftop owners being able to seek damages. So on the Cubs' end, they think we're out of this and we're going to go ahead. And we tried to play ball with the rooftop owners. We tried to negotiate. We tried to have arbitration. But the rooftop owners are not willing to budge on anything. So they're saying, screw it. We feel like we are legally in the right. And what's going to happen is they're going to go to arbitration. And I don't see a situation really where the Cubs are going to lose. Is they have, not only do they have a vote from the Chicago City Council, they have the mayor on record saying that he approved this. They have their alderman on record saying that he approved this. They have the wording of the contract, which is very vague and allows for the Cubs to do these things. And then they also have the full backing of Major League Baseball, a multi-billion dollar corporation. I don't see the rooftop owners winning this, and I think that it's going to cost them in the end, and they should play nice and take what they can get at this point. I mean, their whole business is based on stealing a product that they somehow finagled into, became legal stealing because they got the okay from the Cubs to steal the product. But it's a little bit silly. Now let's look at the financials of the Cubs. Looking at the payroll was $144 million almost in 2010. Then it went down to 140, then 107, then $100 million. And it could be as low as around $85 million by the end of this season. You know, by the time trade deadline comes around, the Cubs' payroll could be about $85 million, which would put them as one of the lowest payroll teams in all of baseball. And that should say something because they're a big market team and a high revenue team. So we're looking at a conservative estimate of around $80 million to start coming in on the revenue side from this new TV deal immediately. But then once the 2019 deal ends with Comcast Sports, to really be able to kick that up a notch and be able to bring in much more additional funds that are needed to build the baseball product on the field. By the time that the Cubs return to like a modestly competitive state, considering the history of the fan base, attendance is likely to really swing upwards too. Cubs fans are a lot different than White Sox fans, that they're a lot less fickle. So the Cubs start putting a better product on the field. What we're looking at is the ability for the team to really see improvement at the box office as well, and the amount of attendance there is at the games. Consider that there's probably going to be an increase in ticket sales and attendance beginning in 2015, which is not really unreasonable to project. Even a modest increase of, say, a couple hundred thousand people at the gates over the year, that could result in another $12, $13 million more of a profit to throw into baseball operation. And then if you have an increase in the competitiveness of the team and, you know, improvement in the financial climate of the country and good weather and beer tasting delicious, you're really going to see the benefit of this and probably come close to the three and a half million people at the gate, probably more than $3 million attendance for a year. And that's really going to increase the amount of sales for the Cubs and their revenue generation and generating revenue, and be able to put that in, hopefully, into baseball operations to continue to increase and provide a better product on the field. As discussed previously, the Cubs will carry a considerable amount of debt going through at least 2019, when the partnership with the Tribune Holding Company expires, and that they're able to pay off a lot of these debts, which they're not able to do now in a timely fashion. To the extent that the debt service payment and other restrictions related to the debt artificially limit the Cubs' ability to spend revenue on the baseball side, because if you're mandated by baseball to have the certain amount of operating income above your debt, is that what you have to think about it is all these payroll thing, expenditure things that the Chicago Cubs have, the one that really gives you, you can't control who comes to the box office, you can't control what the renovations cost, you know, upkeep of the stadium. You can't control, you know, what you're required to spend for minor league spending. The thing you can control is your current major league baseball payroll. And that's where you get a lot of the flexibility. And it's part of the reason that the Cubs are taking on a lower payroll is to keep until these big cash flows start coming in. The Cubs have to maintain, they can't pay off debt to bring it down because that violates their agreement with the Tribune and would cause the IRS to come in after the Tribune. They can't pay off their debt, and they have to maintain a certain profit above this debt in order to satisfy what Major League Baseball is requiring. So it really forces the Cubs, even though they're not cash poor, to be financially strapped because of contractual obligations, which is a really crappy position to be in for the Chicago Cubs. So until some of these other revenue streams come in, whether that be the signage that they're fighting for, whether that be the new television deal, whether that be the IRS comes in and says, this is actually a sale and not a partnership, and then they can pay off some of the debt and be able to increase the amount they spend, or fans coming back to the stadium. If any of those things come through, suddenly you're able to put more money into baseball operations and your payroll. So over the next 5 years, understand that the Cubs are going to be having more income to be able to put towards the baseball team, the baseball side of things. So there's limitations that may gradually ease over the course of the next 5 years. Understanding that there's a $30 to $35 million in debt service currently paid annually, you can consider that that figure extra revenue at some point during the near future, perhaps by 2020, if the bulk is not paid down by 2019 when this partnership goes away. The Jumbotron, like I just mentioned, could generate another $15 to $25 million annually, and the Cubs would receive around $10 million from Budweiser for the exclusive right to sell beer in the stands. Their local broadcast deals are up for renewal in 2015, and the current value at around $50 million between WGN and Comcast Sports. So there's a lot of money that's coming soon down the pipeline, but that doesn't really satisfy us as fans because we're seeing garbage on the field. So basically, the Cubs' issue isn't revenue, but it's their debt load, which Forbes is another financial publication. They estimate their debt load at 35% of the franchise value. Assuming that this debt is financed at 5% over 30 years, that represents about $27 million in debt service annually. So that's a lot of money that they're just paying on loans that they can't get rid of until this partnership with the Tribune goes away. And I don't know what the language in the contract for the sale is, if they're required to not pay that off by some sort of contractual obligation, or how that, or what ramifications the Tribune company could have if the Cubs just paid these loans down. But still, they're paying interest on loans that they don't need to have, and they're not allowed to spend a certain amount of money because they have these certain amount of loans that they're contractually obligated to have, even though they have the money to pay it down. So I keep harping on this, but that's part of the situation with the Cubs. And then so with the Wrigley renovations, they need to begin sooner rather than later. So the work of Theo Epstein and Jed Hoyer needs to translate into a winning team, and the future revenue stream projections need to be essentially correct. Every item is achievable out of the things I've talked about, the Jumbotron, the increased fandom because of a new stadium and better team on the field and the TV rights and all these things. They're all achievable. They're all things that are coming down the pipeline. But the last remaining obstacle is for the Cubs to actually have a good product is creating this new Wrigley Field. And the one hurdle for that is the rooftop owners, which we started the whole conversation on. So the major hurdle is basically the rooftop owners. And because most baseball experts agree that the Cubs could see these young players actually come to fruition as early as next season. So they have the young players and they have the baseball experts in position, and hopefully they can get this new stadium deal. So just to kind of – I've been rambling on for like 15 minutes, but to basically sum this up is really complicated situation of why the Cubs are in the position that they're in. So we have the new ownership saying we can't afford to spend like the Tribune Company was spending before, because even though we have this huge amount of money coming in as far as revenue, we have huge loans that we had to take out to buy the Cubs. And because the Tribune Company dictated the terms of the sale because they owned the Cubs and they didn't want to pay the taxes on it while they were filing for bankruptcy, you know, tried to skirt the law by creating this partnership in which the Cubs can't pay down the loans, even though they have the money to be able to do it from baseball operations income. They can't pay the loans down because it violates the terms with the Tribune. And baseball is saying, well, if you're carrying all of these loans, this is the max amount you can spend based on your revenue. So you can only spend this amount of money. So it really handcuffs. It's not just handcuffed behind their back. It's the Cubs are handcuffed on one hand to the Tribune and their contractual obligations, and they're handcuffed with the other hand to Major League Baseball and their rules under the collective bargaining agreement. And until either that partnership dissolves, which the IRS can come in and say, oh yeah, this is nonsense and we are making you pay. Until either that happens, that contract ends in 2019 with the Tribune Company, where the Cubs can pay down their debt, or the collective bargaining agreement changes with baseball and that they have more freedom to spend, or these new income streams come to fruition, the Cubs are a little bit handcuffed in what they can do. But the good news is that the Cubs are going forward with their plans for Wrigley Field. So they'll have this big signage that'll bring in money. They have this partnership with Budweiser, which drives me crazy because they own the St. Louis Cardinals. So it's kind of like the Cardinals are advertising in our own field. But they'll have this money coming in. And they have the new TV deal after next season, which will bring in more money, which is all more money that the Cubs are allowed to spend on baseball side. So we can bring in these free agents while we're bringing up the young crop of players. So the original estimate of next year being the year when you'll see a better product on the field, it's probably not. We're probably looking at 2016, 2017, because that's when we'll be able to have the money to sign free agents. And hopefully that starts bringing more fans back to the game, which increases the revenue. And I really see the predicament that the Ricketts family is in with this team, but I also see light at the end of the tunnel. And I look – maybe I'm an eternal optimist, but I look at this and I see bright things in the future. So that's going to wrap up this financial talk of the Chicago Cubs. If you guys have any questions, or I was not clear, or you just wanted to tell me shut up and don't ever ramble about things like that ever again, just – contact the show at swerskisports.com. That's Swerski Sports, S-W-E-R-S-K-I, sports.com. And that's going to wrap up another episode of Bill Swerski Sports Talk Chicago. We're going to have a really big episode next week. We're going to have author Stuart Shea, who wrote a book called Wrigley Field, The Long Life and Contentious Times of the Friendly Confines. And he's going to be on the show talking with us about the book, about the Cubs. And so we'll have all that next week. Plus, hopefully, we're talking about the Blackhawks returning to the Stanley Cup Finals. Until then, keep checking us out at swerskisports.com. And thanks for listening. This is Sean with Bill Swerski Sports Talk Chicago.
Cubs win! What a lucky break! The good Lord wants the Cubs to win!
We thank Ditka and God for all they have provided.
Cubs win! Cubs win! Cubs win!
Oh, I don't want her. You can have her. She's a Packer fan. She can't fit in my van.
And she looks like...
Remember, New Yorkers, smoking crack is not legal on planes.
Bears 31 to negative 7.
The Bears!
Oh, when the Bears go bearing down...